Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to, meeting will come to order February 17th. We are going to continue with our agenda from Monday evening when we had to adjourn at regular time. And we were just going to begin, we had had more time, with the report on the use of funds from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Mr. Fox? Mr. Anfison? Welcome, Mr. Fox. Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to share some highlights of the work the Society has done over the past 6 months with the funds you have provided us to help preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. These projects and programs may not be literally oozing cool, as we heard on Monday, but many people statewide are very excited about the opportunities and benefits that they are already providing. You have in your materials the report that we submitted to the legislature and the governor. It's photographs, a blue cover. Additionally, in that packet, there should be a handout that shows of a map that shows the distribution of the grants that have been awarded statewide. In the report, we discussed the specifics of the work that we've done on all six of the specific appropriations made, but this morning I'd like to focus on activities in three particular areas: our work with the grants program, our educational initiatives, and our partnerships with the state's public library systems. With respect to the grants, let me turn your attention to the map here. Will help illustrate perhaps what I'm about to, my remarks. The Historic Resources Advisory Committee that was set up in the appropriation language is the body that makes the determination, awards these grants that are submitted through our usual grants process. That committee decided that they would make grants in three categories by size: the small camp grants, those less than seven, mid-sized grants up to $50,000, and the large grants over $50,000. If you look at the on the map, the small black dots show the 86 fast track or small grants that were awarded up through December. With January's submissions, that number will go up another 33 to about 119. These grants are awarded monthly. Organizations submit them, they were reviewed, and they are approved the following month. The idea was to get the money out into the community as quickly as possible for these smaller grants. The larger grants, the mid and large size grants, cover awards of larger than $7,000. 27 of those were granted by the committee after 2 days of public testimony in November. 58 of the 63 eligible applicants came and made presentations and answered questions by the committee, which carefully reviewed each of the applications and made awards of approximately $1.5 million. In total, when we finish this process next month, we anticipate there will be about 180 to 185 awards made statewide. And we've already begun the work on the next cycle. The applications for the next round of grants from next year's appropriation have already started to come in. The committee will review those in June so that when the funds are available on July 1, we will be able to issue the contracts, and the recipients will have the maximum amount of time to complete those projects before the completion of the biennium. With regard to our educational programs, I point out that 80% of the funds that were appropriated to the Society for its programs and purposes have been assigned either directly or indirectly to support for K-12 education in the state. Let me share a few of the highlights of the programs that we put in place to serve the educational community. We have programs for teachers. We will have 9 workshops this year for 350-plus teachers on their use of Minnesota history and social studies instruction. 130 teachers have registered for a workshop in April on the use of the Northern Lights textbook that we publish for use in sixth grade. New curriculum materials are Native American history and Minnesota history are being developed, along with a project that we call Lumberjack Math that uses history to to teach basic computational skills. And we will have a pilot immersion project with 10 teachers this year at the Oliver Kelly Farm, helping them to use that site as a teaching resource. We have programs aimed at students. The most visible will be the availability of live interactive educational programs that are now available only at the History Center or through our historic sites. These programs will be now, starting next fall, available on the web through interactive video conferencing to schools who either can't come to the sites or to the History Center, or who really want to use that curriculum at a point in the year when it best fits into the teaching schedule. Our field visits are typically in the fall and the spring, and that's not necessarily the time when the teachers need it in their teaching cycle, in their curriculum. So this is an opportunity to deliver that those experiences statewide on an as-needed basis. Our new traveling exhibits on Minnesota's regional history called Our Minnesota, Tall Grass, Tall Trees, and Tall Buildings is being aimed at school groups and families with children. It will complement the state history standards and support the Northern Lights textbook. It's really our first exhibit that is primarily focused at that audience. Additionally, we are expanding our services to the National History Day program that now serves over 30,000 students statewide. We're increasing staff support for History Day schools in areas that we've not been able to serve well with existing resources, particularly in Duluth and Points North and in the St. Cloud area. We are creating new partnerships with four Minsky campuses, Winona, Moorhead, St. Cloud, and Mankato, to develop undergraduate mentoring programs where college students will work with teachers and students in the classrooms. We hope to place 12 mentors with four on, well, we actually have already placed 12 mentors at each of four campuses. Previously, this program is only available at the Twin Cities, Duluth, and Morris campuses. We have a lot of educational programs and history programs that are also being done in conjunction with the state's public library system, so let me turn to those partnerships. In working with the 12 regional public library systems, we came to an agreement that we would focus on four areas of partnership. The first was to educate people of all ages about the history of Minnesota's greatest generation through engaging programs at library venues statewide. The Minnesota's greatest generation exhibit that I hope you've seen at the History Center has clearly captured the interest of the library community and others in the state, and the library systems wanted to use it as the focus of our first partnership program with them. As a result, we are going to prepare for each district library a set of 8 all-inclusive event kits that included MGG-themed kits for 4 family nights, 2 craft days, a film festival, and a trivia night. These kits provide everything the library will need in response to requests for turnkey programming from small public libraries that don't necessarily have the staff to develop these programs themselves. We're working to document and preserve the stories of the greatest generation. The Society will teach oral history training workshops for libraries and volunteers so that those library staff can provide that oral history instruction in their own public libraries. Additionally, we'll be providing a 2-day workshop by a group called TV by Girls on the basics of filming and editing oral history interviews. We want to work with the communities to bring projects that document the history of those communities together on an intergenerational basis. Local libraries and the Society's historic sites are working together on projects at Jeffers, Pine City, Anoka, Little Falls, Grand Rapids, Preston, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And History Center staff are working directly with public libraries in Wilmer, Wadena, Warroad, Pelican Rapids, and Virginia on intergenerational projects that bring together young people and seniors to work on projects that document their communities. Finally, we're partnering with 6 regional library networks to support local libraries as they serve as resources to the History Day program. We expect to serve 39 schools and approximately 5,800 students in this program through this spring History Day competitions. Well, those are just a few of the highlights of our first 6 months' work. I'd be happy to answer any questions or amplify in any of my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. That sounds kind of exciting.
We are very
pretty
excited.
Pretty exciting, actually. For local history societies that want more information, who do they call?
If they're looking for history information about programs or the grants or any?
For the grants.
There are two venues. We have on our website, mnhs.org/legacy, all the information about the grants program, the grants guidelines, the list of projects that have been awarded. So that information is there. They can also call our local history office, who work directly with those local societies, helping them to prepare grants so that we have the most competitive pool of applicants that we possibly can have. So either the website or a call to our staff.
And the next round have to be in by?
The pre-applications, I believe, are due in March, and the applications themselves will be due in April. As I say, the committee will be reviewing those in June. Hopefully, we'll be able to disperse those, issue the contracts, etc., as soon after July 1 as possible. We want to get the money in their hands so they have the full use of that money for a full year.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scott Anfinson. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
You have a report, or you?
Very briefly, I can just summarize. We've awarded two contracts in the statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites, and those surveys are for a LIDAR, the use of LIDAR to survey burial mounds both in Crow Wing and in Scott counties, one a high development sort of metro sprawl area and the other a high lakeshore development area. So we'll be using LIDAR for that, which we're very excited about. The second one we're also excited about, very different. We're studying traditional cultural properties and sacred sites of the Indian community in the metropolitan area, so we can sort of try to avoid some of the problems that, some of you remember the Highway 55 project that got very upsetting to a lot of people. We're trying to identify those sacred sites and the traditional cultural properties early so we can be more proactive in their protection. We also have five RFPs ready to go. And they will be, first of all, a survey of Swift County for historical and archaeological sites, then a survey of Olmsted County, and those two should be out fairly soon. Then we want to do a survey of the North Shore to really look up at some of the archaeological resources up there. Then we're going to do very interesting studies, one of them to try to find the earliest Aboriginal ceramics in Minnesota, maybe the earliest in this country, maybe located in northern Minnesota. We're going to study that. They're called Brainerd ceramics. And then we're going to do a study. We're going to try to find the earliest sites that ever were occupied in Minnesota by people, maybe 12,000 years ago. So those RFPs should be coming out fairly soon, and I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund framework, Ms. Kyer, Ms. Jens, Director Rubenstein, Romanstein.
What do we do to them?
All three of you together. Good.
We wanted to give you the best.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and each of the three of us will have a piece of the report that we're going to give you today, and mine will be the briefest, principally a refresher for all of you about the process and the assignment that you gave us, and then we'll turn to the reports and what we learned in that process. I hope that this information won't be new to you. We've had a chance to be here now twice. This is our third time. We were here in August and in December giving you updates. We hope you've had a chance to be informed and to raise any questions or concerns that you've had about the process throughout. Just a reminder, you charged the three of us, our agencies, with coordinating a planning process involving the programs or the organizations who are being funded by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund in this first two-year cycle. You intentionally asked us to collaborate, to bring those interests together, to conduct public hearings so that we would understand what Minnesotans think is important about this new fund and what they want to accomplish with it, and also to give a vision and some measurable outcomes and goals for the future for the fund. We hope we've done that, and we hope that when you have a chance to hear the highlights of the report, you will agree. Very quickly about the process. In August of 2009, we issued a call for nominations for the selection committee members. That was done through the State Register. It was also posted on a website created specifically for this planning process. And we used email, all of us used email to try to encourage people to go to that website, stay informed, and nominate themselves. 50 individuals were nominated to serve on the planning committee. We used a set of criteria that we developed ahead of time to make the selection, and those included things like expertise in one or more of the areas that the fund represented, evidence that the nominee had broadly represented his or her field, evidence of working collaboratively, evidence of successful long-range planning experience, experience in and knowledge of arts and cultural heritage in the state of Minnesota. And we also strove for gender balance, geographic balance, balance of large and small organizations, metro and greater organizations. And we had roughly half and half metro and greater Minnesota members. The 13 members were selected. Their names are in the report. And we also hired an external facilitator to help guide the committee's process. The committee met four times, basically once a month, in October, November, December, and January. At the December meeting, they reviewed a draft report. At the January meeting, which was in early January, they looked at what was the final report that you have in front of you. The meeting dates and times were posted on that central website that we had created, and those meetings were open to the public. Committee members also attended the public listening sessions that Andrea will talk about in just a moment. All of the members of the planning committee served as volunteers. They were not compensated for their time or their expenses. They were doing it as a labor of love and as a real public service, wanting to be part of this planning process. The last thing I say before I'll hand off to Andrea is that there was a report in the Star Tribune that some of you saw that was critical of the process. The reporter who wrote the report attended one of the planning committee meetings. He was there for the full meeting. He interviewed the three of us. He interviewed other members of the committee and included some of the information he had gleaned in that report, but not all of it. So we felt that the report in the newspaper didn't really give a complete and accurate picture of the process, and we hope that we have given you a better and a more complete picture of what that process was like and how it worked. I'm going to hand off to Andrea, and she'll talk about the public input.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Jens, one more clarification. You did not make any appropriations.
Madam Chair.
At all. You did not have money to make any appropriations.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you didn't ask us to do that. You asked us to clarify a vision and set some possible long-range goals for the process, but we had no funding authority.
And your process started in August.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And appropriations that were listed in the article that you mentioned had been done by the legislature, the House of Representatives, and the Senate Conference Committee as a result of the bills that went through the House and the Senate. Those were appropriations that we all made recommendations on and that the House and Senate voted on. You were not given any money to carry out this assignment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Jens, I just want to make sure I got there. Are you suggesting that a member of the press got an article wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, there was much about the article that was right. I can't attribute motive. There was much about the process and what was gleaned through the meeting that was not in the article, and we wish that all of that information had been included in the article.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Jens, Madam Chair, I think you bring out a very good point that, I should just thank Ms. Jens and the folks at the front table for taking the fall for what we did.
Ms. Kyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Andrea Hart-Kyer. I'm Deputy Director for External Relations for the Minnesota Historical Society, and I just want to give you a little bit about what we learned in our public hearing processes that we took around the state, and then Stanley will talk about the report. We took the assignment that you gave us very seriously, and we were trying to give it our best advice on how to make the biggest impact on the state of Minnesota. In doing so, as Sue mentioned, we did 6 public hearings. We had over 450 attendees at those public hearings. We also, as we've mentioned, had it in the social media world on a website, LinkedIn, Facebook. We received over 3,000 hits on the website. At all times, our findings and the draft report were up on the web for anyone to review and comment. So we were really trying to make this process transparent. What we did hear was an overarching theme that Minnesota was doing a good job in the art, history, and cultural areas, but this was a great opportunity to build on the programs that are going on currently. There was an emphasis that the money be used for programs in particular, and the money, as you know, would not supplant other sources of funding such as the K-12 budget or the capital bonding process. There was much input on greater collaboration across the art and cultural heritage disciplines and geography throughout the state, that art, history, and cultural heritage is for lifelong learners from the K-12 and early childhood all the way to senior members of the Society for Lifelong Learning. People repeatedly ask that it be accessible and affordable throughout the state of Minnesota, and that we have a better understanding of cultures, getting other cultures engaged, that this money leave a legacy as it was intended to by the voters, and that there be an increased awareness and understanding of the Native American history and culture in the state of Minnesota. So those were kind of the overriding things that we have, and we do have all those findings that we can provide to you if you need to. And with that, I would turn it over to Stanley.
Mr. Romanstein.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name, for the record, is Stanley Romanstein. I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center. The report that you have in front of you, Minnesota State of Innovation, reflects our task force's best thinking, our best recommendations about how to use these funds to the benefit of citizens throughout the state. We think that our recommendations accomplish 4 aims. We think that first, our recommendations acknowledge and build upon Minnesota's considerable strength in the areas of arts, history, and cultural heritage. We think, second, that our recommendations provide greater access to programs in our history and cultural heritage for people across our state. We think, third, that our recommendations provide needed stability for our state's arts, history, and cultural heritage ecosystem. And we think, finally, that these recommendations both honor our strong tradition in arts, history, and cultural heritage, and at the same time, opens the door wide for new voices, new perspectives, new ideas as we move forward. The report is divided into 8 sections. The first is a statement of background. How did we get here? What's the genesis of this report? We give a 25-year vision. What do we think the impact of these funds might be, and how could we establish Minnesota as a real center for creativity, innovation, and imagination through using these funds? The third section really articulates a 25-year framework, which you asked us to do. There are 11 guiding principles. There are no recommendations for dollars, but 11 guiding principles that we would suggest for using the funds. There is a 10-year plan, a sort of halfway point, a benchmark to get us toward those 25-year goals. The 10-year plan offers 6 specific recommendations on how the funds could be used. The next section, Section 5, lists some measurable goals and outcomes for the next 10 years. How is it that we'll know that we're on the right path? We offer a brief conclusion, and we offer 2 appendices. One that lists our definitions. We understand that definitions are tricky, but we wanted to tell you what we intended as we worked together. What did we mean by arts? What did we mean by cultural heritage? Etc., and you'll see those. And the last appendix is a listing of all the committee members. And I would re-articulate Ms. Jen's comment. These 13 citizens worked diligently, they worked well, they worked for the greater interest of the state, and they worked without compensation of any kind. And I think that they deserve our thanks. I think it's also important to note with this report that that we were unanimous in our opinions. There is no minority report that is coming forth from the task force. We spoke with one mind on all of these. We did struggle with definitions throughout our process. What is cultural heritage? That's an open question. And again, we've given you our working answer, and I know that you two are deliberating about definitions. We also struggled with measurements and benchmarks and how those could be applied broadly to all of our endeavors and yet still be valid and still be informative as we're moving forward. We think there's more work to be done in the area of measurements, but we had to stop where we stopped. We're confident in our recommendations, and we're confident that they'll serve the people of Minnesota well. We're deeply appreciative to you for giving us the responsibility for creating the recommendations, and we're pleased to deliver the report to you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've read the report, and I want to thank the folks that are before us here for the work that they've done. I think this is very helpful. I was just wondering, though, for definitions, how do you plan to protect, enhance, or restore the arts, and do you favor buying property or lifetime leases? Just kidding. And Andrew, I just want to know if you got some Toby Keith tapes yet.
Yeah, right. I went out and bought them right away.
Good for you. Okay. Thank you. No, that's in all seriousness, yes. Madam Chair, I think they did a good job here as I read through it.
Very good starting point. And we appreciate the efforts of the Committee of 13 that gave up so much time to put this together and to begin the conversations. And we accept this report at this time, but we will have further discussion about it on another day. But we want to receive it so that it's in our possession.
Thank you, Madam.
Any other comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pollution Control Agency, Plan for Civic Engagement in TMDL Development. Mr. Scuta, Ms. Latimer, Lothhammer.
Exactly. It's a good German right. name, so lots of consonants.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Glenn Scuta with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, manager in watershed programs, and here to give you a very brief update or report on the legislative report on civic engagement and TMDL development submitted last November. Just make sure we're all on the same page. TMDL, total maximum daily load, that's a scientific study that's done to determine the ability of a water body to remain unimpaired or to meet water quality standards, set the pollution limits that would enable the water body to remain unimpaired, and then to allocate those pollution limits amongst sources of pollution to that water body. So it's both a scientific process to determine the water body's capacity, and it's also a social process to figure out how to allocate those limits of pollution to the water. So the report focuses on the civic engagement aspect of doing total maximum daily loads in our watershed work. A little background, the Clean Water Legacy Act 2006 requires that participation by the public and stakeholders be encouraged early and often by a broad base of citizens and stakeholders in development of our watershed projects and total maximum daily loads. So to that end, the Clean Water Council, which was created by the Clean Water Legacy Act, has been studying opportunities for civic engagement and what would be the most effective methods for truly engaging citizens in a more meaningful and better and stronger way over the past year or more. And the council has developed guidelines for engaging citizens and stakeholders. And the report really outlines in a broad way how to do that and what should be included in efforts to involve citizens more thoroughly in TMDL development. but does not get into specifics about on any individual project how that should be done, because that's kind of the heart of the matter, is that it is a case-by-case basis of working with citizens on specific projects in their local areas, utilizing local knowledge to determine what does work best on any given particular project. But the report does give much more detail than I'll give this morning on the general framework for civic engagement. This diagram kind of shows that this is a cycle and a process that is ongoing of involving citizens in protecting and restoring water quality in the state. It recognizes that citizens are going to be the implementers. They're going to be the drivers of correcting water quality problems and protecting our resources, whether they be farmers and how they manage their agricultural lands, whether it be lake cabin owners and how they manage their septic systems and shoreland, whether it be suburban or urban homeowners and how they manage their lawns, etc. But the concept is to get citizens involved meaningfully early on in our processes of developing our watershed protection and restoration plans, such that they will be invested in the solutions that are developed. They will help create the solutions and then want to implement them. So the cycle kind of shows how, you know, it really starts again. There's a lot of science in the front end of determining the capacity of the water body, setting the load limits, that type of thing. But that's framing the problem to give people a context to begin with. Why is this lake or why is this stream impaired? But then early on in the process to engage citizens, we need to assess what is the potential for engaging citizens in a given project, asking the citizens of a given area, what are the best ways to involve people in that culture, that society, and then integrating civic engagement into the actual project plans as we develop the solutions. Engaging in a broader base of citizens in watersheds, and then learning from that process and adjusting. I think not to draw too stark of a distinction between moving to this approach in the past, because there has been a lot of good work attempting to engage citizens in the past, but in a coarse way, I'd say that in the past, we've kind of short-circuited this cycle, as the red arrow shows, where we've kind of framed the problem and brought that problem to the citizens kind of sometimes after the fact and said, okay, how do we fix this? Rather than being more deliberate and engaging them in that process of framing the problem and figuring out with them how to better engage a broader citizen base. So that, I think, is the shift here that we're trying to make with moving to a broader civic engagement process versus a typical public participation process. This is the broader context of all the watershed work we do. The report was to focus and did focus primarily on the upper right-hand part of that cycle, the development of TMDLs and watershed restoration and protection strategies and implementation plans. And then the principle being that if civic engagement is done well in that process, that will carry through into the next step of implementation activities. Want to note, though, that in monitoring and assessment, we have been doing civic engagement there as well, and really have been for decades in terms of involving citizen monitors and helping collect water quality information on lakes and streams of the state of Minnesota. And that's been a great tool to get people engaged and involved in protecting and restoring their waters. So civic engagement really needs to happen and does happen throughout the entire cycle, not just in the development of the strategies and the TMDLs. And where we're beginning to do this work more and more, the map on the left shows where our intensive watershed monitoring efforts have been underway since 2006 and up through where they will take place this summer on a major watershed basis. And then following on that, we're working in this transition time to sync up then the development of the TMDLs and civic engagement in those activities in different watersheds across the state as well. And there's not complete agreement between those two maps right now as we're in transition, but as we move forward with more of our TMDL and watershed projects, we will be syncing up those with the watersheds where the intensive watershed monitoring has occurred as well. These are watersheds on the map on the right where we are trying to incorporate these civic engagement principles into the watershed plan development that is either underway now already for projects that are ongoing or projects that will be beginning shortly with funding from this session's appropriations. So basically the concept is that we're trying to make a shift to more thorough civic engagement in our watershed work, trying to put citizens less in a reactive kind of a mode of reacting to work and study that's been done and getting them involved more upfront and allowing them to be more proactive in developing solutions along with government. Moving them from being kind of individual commenters on particular projects to being involved in cooperative and collaborative processes. And moving away from assuming that the typical types of public meetings and public processes we've done in the past are sufficient, moving away from assuming that and asking rather in the local areas what would work, what methods of collaboration and communication cooperation would be worthwhile and helpful and engage people in a meaningful way. So that's all I have for this brief update. I'd be happy to take any questions or comments you have on the presentation or the report.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Skuda, just wondering, at this time, what percent of the streams and lakes has monitoring been completed on?
Mr. Skuda.
I'm going to turn this over to Shannon Lotthammer. Shannon's the manager of our monitoring section, so she's got better information than I.
Ms. Lotthammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. At this point, we have about 20% of our watersheds around the state, and there's about 81 of them total, that where the intensive monitoring has either been started or completed. We'll be starting another 7 this summer, so once we get into the summer, it'll be about 30% of our watersheds that will be actively being monitored.
So the map on the left-hand side of this this slide shows the watersheds that have been monitored, or the darkest blue ones are the ones that are beginning this summer.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. The statute that governs all of these monies says that you need to be able to, and you need to have measurable outcomes and to evaluate your results. You didn't talk to us about that. Can you help us out here?
Mr. Skuta.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius. Yes, we are working to develop measures for all of the outcomes we need to achieve. Some are more easily quantifiable, as in numbers of watersheds monitored or where a report is done, that type of thing. For civic engagement specifically, we're trying to determine what the best measures would be. As a starting point, at a minimum, we will be developing case studies and success stories on where civic engagement processes have been undertaken and how successful they've been. That's going to be, in some cases, hard to quantify. One effort that we've been working with the U.S. Federal Environmental Protection Agency on for a couple of years now, is referred to as the Social Indicators Project, does give us some tools where we can quantify the level of involvement in watershed work. And it can do that at different levels, on a project level or larger. But using survey tools and such, it can actually provide us a little bit more quantifiable information than just sort of more subjective information. We've been piloting that over the last couple of years with the US EPA in places like Duluth, and we hope that utilizing those tools will enable us to better quantify some of the measurable outcomes from our work on the social side of this, not just on the scientific side.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Skuda. Last night we were in Representative Eakin's committee, and we heard from the DNR about enforcement activities related to invasive species and how enforcement investment had worked. And I'm just looking at the flow chart here on civic engagement, and I'm not sure in the report anywhere that I see the word enforcement or compliance and how that relates to civic engagement. I mean, if there are enforcement actions taken and integrating evaluation of enforcement and compliance activities related to the surface water protection. you maybe tell us how that's incorporated in, or what's done within compliance and enforcement in the civic engagement model?
Mr. Scuda.
Citizens always have the ability to register complaints with us or provide us with information on where there's, you know, the appearance at least of laws being violated. And all complaints are investigated that we receive from the public. It's not specified or discussed in this report directly. I think this report is focusing more on sort of the solution development side of civic engagement. But that is certainly always the a potential role and right of citizens to report to us potential violations that they're seeing.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, my question is a little differently, rather than making complaints, but on when there is enforcement action taken, or what is the result of enforcement action, and how that's integrated into the civic engagement so that you involve the citizenry, that they're aware of when there's enforcement actions taken. You can look at the results of enforcement actions, and do they, does that that leg of the of, or the tool in the toolbox, to over use a statement, you know, how does that engage in? Is there a feedback mechanism when you're, when the agency is taking enforcement action relating to surface water protection, so that civic engagement can occur and people can see that?
Mr. Scuta.
Representative, I think that's a good concept for us to take to heart. There are things known as supplemental environmental projects that can be done in some cases when we take an enforcement action, where rather than just a company paying a fine, they do a supplemental environmental activity that will have a positive impact on the resource that was adversely impacted by the violation. So that's a tool, again, that's been around for a long time, but that may be something we should think more directly about incorporating into this this model. We do publicize enforcement actions, at least on a quarterly basis, kind of statewide generally. But again, I think it's a good concept of when we are working in a particular watershed and there are violations or enforcement actions that are taken, to make sure that that information is communicated with the people that are participating in the watershed work. Compliance enforcement and the civic social engagement are kind of both valid and useful tools.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Scuda, I really like the tone and the approach of real involvement as opposed to just consultation. You note here that there's considerable variety in the readiness of different parts of the state, different parts of organizations to evolve to this. And I didn't hear you talking about how you're going to train people and really kind of lift them up to a common level of participation. Are you just going to send out the checklist and the tools and hope that the quality of the materials is what's going to happen? I mean, is there a feedback loop back to the agency? And also, it seemed like the least amount of information on this to guide those groups is really about the implementation strategy, and that to me is the heart of it all. And so I think it's important to have spent a lot of time on the front end in terms of how do you get people involved and to own the process, but they have to also own the solutions, and there has to be some uniform quality across the state. And could you tell me what the oversight is going to be as we move forward with this?
Mr. Scuda.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, the work that's being done right now, we're really at kind of the front end of this, and right now the bulk of the work has been developing the vision and kind of now the toolbox of guidelines and such. We do have a staff assigned to this and another staff that had already been working on this involved that is actively going out and meeting with groups all over the state to take these tools out to them and begin to train folks on that local level. So it's not just kind of a mail it out and hope that it works. We are utilizing staff to train. We'll be training our additional internal staff, our project management staff that oversee the TMDL work, more and more in this as time goes on as well, so they will also be able to help train local entities that we already partner with on doing this type of work, so that the tools do get utilized well. And yes, certainly, Representative, the concept is not just to kind of inform people up front and have them involved just in the upfront part, but it is, yes, all about directing all that energy toward developing solutions that are truly implementable because they were developed by the people that are the implementers as well. So it is meant to be holistic, not just kind of an upfront process that goes away, but that leads into an ongoing process of involvement by the citizens in implementation activities.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
On page 2, you note that some of the most effective methods of engaging landowners have involved modest cash incentives and peer pressure. Given limited resources, I'm wondering what the role of, to me, cash incentives actually work against effective citizen engagement. When the cash goes away, then people don't feel like they want to be involved and they don't have the ownership. So I didn't see it in any of your check boxes, but I really wanted to understand that because I don't know that that's a strategy I think is sustainable.
Representative, or Mr. Scuta.
Madam Chair, Representative. That is referring to some work and study that's gone on in Iowa on, again, what are some of the ways that have shown to best engage citizens. And it is certainly a strategy that's been used for a long time, particularly in the unregulated arenas such as agriculture, to provide some amount of cost share or cash incentives to help enable the work that needs to be done to be implemented. The concept, I think, is to build this civic engagement work into the project work that's being done utilizing the Clean Water Fund monies. And for TNBL development, and then of course those projects feed into implementation activities also funded by the Clean Water Fund through Board of Water and Soil Resources and other agencies. So there is money that is available that is targeted through the Clean Water Fund for implementation activities developed through these processes. And I guess it's a lot more about making sure that we are targeting that money wisely to the areas that are causing the most problems, providing enough incentive to get people to act without sort of overtaxing the system in terms of the amount of money that we are passing through. It is a typical strategy in the non-point source implementation world of providing some amount of cost share or tax incentive to help initiate some action.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Lotheimer. I follow up a little bit to my question previously, and also I think Representative Wagenius. Of the 20% that have been monitored so far, what percent of the streams and waters, lakes, are impaired?
Ms. Lotheimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl. Basically, the numbers that we're seeing kind of on a statewide average is about 40% of the waters are impaired and about 60% of the waters are unimpaired. And it varies across the state, but kind of overall, that's the general number.
Thank you. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Scuta. I too, like as Representative Loeffler said, the tone, and I think that it's important to develop good public relations with the citizens and the civic engagement here. I think goes a long ways towards that, especially when you consider the fact that the vast majority of contaminants are coming from non-point sources and from privately held lands. If we're going to meet with any success, we're going to have good civic engagement and a good relationship with the private landowners out there. And I just wanted to ask as far as, how you're interacting with other agencies and also with the soil and water conservation districts in our area. They, I think, have a very good relationship with private landholders, and which is so critically important to the success of cleaning up the waters. Have you been engaged with the soil and water conservation districts in the areas? I think they also could serve as a good model to follow.
Mr. Scuta.
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, yes, soil water conservation districts are one of our primary partners in doing our watershed work. And that's kind of what I said earlier. I didn't want to draw too bold of a distinction between moving to this new approach in the past, because a lot of good work has been done in the past on involving citizens, and soil and water conservation districts are one of the primary folks that have accomplished that. So we continue, we have over 80% of our watershed projects are locally led. We pass money through to groups like soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, counties, to be the local leads on the projects. We continue to do that. And then in coordinating with other agencies as well, on development of the civic engagement approach, we've been coordinating very closely with the Board of Water and Soil Resources on this, because they are the agency overseeing the actual implementation part of this cycle, and connecting up with the other agencies as well through our interagency coordinating committees. So yes, we're definitely trying to coordinate this both at the state level and with local units of government.
Thanks.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the advantages you have that wasn't around 10 years ago is there's a lot of media now about, TV programs, et cetera, about waters. One of the big things that everybody knows about now is the dead zone at the end of the Mississippi River, which we contribute to. How do you relate what people know, because you really can only speak to people about what they know, about the dead zone with things going on in Minnesota? Or do you? Maybe you don't. I'm just curious. Do you?
Mr. Scuta.
Madam Chair, Representative Guinness, it's kind of a yes and no question, I think, Representative Guinness, or yes and no answer. We do publicize or make that information known to people, but I think there's some differences of opinion on what actually is more motivating to people. For some people, the fact that there is a dead zone at the Gulf of Mexico is a strong motivator. Unfortunately, for some people, it is not a motivator at all, because it's 1,000 miles away. So it's not something that we put all of our eggs in that basket on, certainly, but it is something that we do talk about as well, so that people are aware of it. For example, in the Lake Pepin TMDL project, which is our largest TMDL project that we'll probably ever do here, there's been quite a bit of conversation about how that relates to the impact on the dead zone. But we are finding, and I think it's an accurate principle, that people are more motivated and driven by what their impacts or the impacts of their neighbors are in more local areas, in their immediate watershed. Is even a stronger driver, of course, than if you're in the middle Minnesota basin, or even in the Twin Cities, than if you are, if you're someone that lives there. What's going on in your local area is much more of a driver than what's going on at Lake Pepin. And what's going on at Lake Pepin is much more of a driver than what's going on at the Gulf of Mexico. So we try to strike a balance there, make sure people are aware of the very distant downstream impacts that their local actions are having, but in many ways putting more emphasis on what's happening here in Minnesota and in their local watersheds. We also, the U.S. Geological Survey information, most recent modeling, Sparrow modeling that they've done on the dead zone has shown that the contribution of Minnesota to the dead zone is a fairly small percentage, not insignificant, but much smaller than other areas, that we're not a big driver there. So we don't want to overplay that either.
If I could just follow up.
Representative Guinness.
Okay. If folks are most, and I understand that, worried about what's happening in their neighborhood, which is what you're saying, do you talk about what's happening in their drinking water?
Mr. Scuta.
On a project-by-project basis, we certainly have done projects that are related to drinking water. We've done clean water partnership projects in the past focused on wellhead areas in places like Cottage Grove and Painesville, for example. We are doing a TMDL project on the Mississippi River from St. Cloud down into the Twin Cities, which involves surface water intakes for St. Cloud, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. And so drinking water does come up regularly in that project, and we're coordinating with the Department of Health to see how we can kind of satisfy both Safe Drinking Water Act requirements and Clean Water Act requirements as we do that project. So, yes, where it is an issue and appropriate, we do involve the drinking water issue in our watershed projects, too.
Okay, just the last. I mean, one of the things, the stuff in the surface water does get down into the groundwater, too, and I think we have not done very much in educating folks about that. But that's where I was going, actually, not the surface water between St. Cloud and
Ms. Lotthammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just take a moment to switch the presentations here. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shannon Lotthammer. Again, I'm the manager of the water monitoring section at the Pollution Control Agency, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here before you today and give you a brief presentation about the groundwater protection spending proposal, which was a legislative report that came out of the last legislative session. So the requirement for this report and to develop this proposal came from the 2009 Clean Water Fund Appropriation Bill. And in that bill, the legislature appropriated $5 million to the Pollution Control Agency from the Clean Water Fund in the second year of the biennium, and that funding was for groundwater protection or prevention of groundwater degradation activities. That was part of the total $13.6 million that was appropriated for groundwater and drinking water activities out of the Clean Water Fund. And the appropriation language required the Pollution Control Agency to consult with the other agencies to develop a report and submit it to the legislature identifying the intended use of that funding. And that is the report that we submitted for the January 15th deadline. And that's what I'll just give you a brief update about today. And then once that report is submitted, the appropriation language further required that the legislature approve the proposed expenditures by law before those funds could be spent. And it's important to note that to develop this proposal, we reviewed existing documents and identified groundwater, drinking water protection needs, and consulted with an interagency work group to actually develop the overall spending proposal. And that interagency approach is very important given that Minnesota employs a multi-agency approach to groundwater protection, where a number of agencies have very specific responsibilities that together lead to groundwater protection at the state level and then working with local government to groundwater protection at the local level as well. So the groups, the state agencies that we worked with included the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Metropolitan Council, the Environmental Quality Board staff, and then also a representative from the Minnesota Geospatial Information Office, which has data management and mapping management responsibilities. We also consulted with the Clean Water Council to get their perspective and input into developing this proposal. So through our review and discussions, we really identified four main areas of need for groundwater protection. Those included long-term monitoring, data access and integration, so making sure that decision makers have access to information about groundwater quality and groundwater threats, support for state and local planning activities, and then implementation, or in other words, putting practices in the ground or and on the land surface in order to prevent groundwater degradation from occurring or to prevent it from expanding in some areas. Now, some of these areas were already supplemented by Clean Water Fund appropriations for the biennium. So, for example, the state agencies are ramping up their activities to monitor vulnerable aquifers and also to better understand groundwater levels to get a better understanding of groundwater supply and sustainability questions. Another example would be enhanced planning and implementation surrounding wellhead protection efforts. The Department of Health received additional funds to accelerate their wellhead protection efforts. But if you look at the graph that's on the presentation, you'll notice that the blue dots, kind of the smaller dots, represent wellhead protection areas. And those are primarily focused on public water supplies. But the red and the green and the blue areas that are shaded on the map are all of the vulnerable aquifers in Minnesota. So Minnesota's vulnerable groundwater resources are broader than public water supplies, and so you'll see that wellhead protection doesn't address all of the vulnerable areas that are in Minnesota. So more effort is needed in the metro area and in greater Minnesota to protect those vulnerable aquifers that lie outside of wellhead protection areas, and this proposal really focused on that need. So in light of the one-time, one-year nature of the appropriation, the proposal really focused on filling immediate needs and then piloting approaches that will inform further protection efforts, particularly at the local level where those practices can best be implemented. This graphic shows just kind of a general breakdown of the spending proposal elements. About 75% of the funding is proposed for on-the-ground protection activities, so implementing groundwater protection practices, and then evaluating the effectiveness of those practices as well. So we have information to continue to refine and guide those implementation efforts. Then about 15% was for enhancing groundwater protection aspects of local water planning efforts, and about 10% for data sharing and data access. This next slide just summarizes more of the proposal elements. The first two entries in the table here are really focused on those on-the-ground protection activities and effectiveness evaluation. And this is focused in those vulnerable aquifers that are outside of wellhead protection areas. And again, wellhead protection is very, very important, but additional resources were provided already for those activities. So this is focused on the areas that are outside of those wellhead protection activities that still involve vulnerable aquifers. Then the third element is for enhancing efforts to incorporate groundwater protection strategies into local water plans, again for those areas that are not addressed by wellhead protection. Representative Wagenius in the previous presentation pointed out the concerns about surface water and groundwater interactions. And one of the things that we noticed in our discussions about this proposal and in developing the report was that local water planning is really focusing a lot on surface water protection, and that's critically important. But there's also an opportunity to enhance groundwater protection at the local level as well. And so this part of the proposal is to provide some resources to identify what might be some of the needs that are there at the local level that might be preventing more focus on groundwater protection, and then piloting some approaches to enhance the groundwater protection aspects of local water plans. So what are some strategies that can effectively enhance the local water or the groundwater protection aspects of those local water planning efforts that are already underway? It's really trying to build on existing local efforts, figure out what some of the needs are and what some of the barriers are to enhance the groundwater protection elements of that. And then the final two elements of the proposal focus on enhancing data sharing and access. And a lot of progress has been made in recent years in enhancing access to data and our environmental data, including groundwater data, but there's definitely still more work to be done, particularly in the area of linking agency systems so that they're more seamless to the user. So folks don't need to know that they go to the Pollution Control Agency for water quality information and the Department of Natural Resources for water quantity information. We can do a better job kind of behind the scenes linking up that information, so whether someone's at the PCA's website or the DNR's website, they can get access to that information, answer the questions that they need to answer to make those informed management decisions. So just briefly in summary, the three main goals then of the proposal that was developed was to implement those pilot projects to enhance protection of vulnerable aquifers, really to set the stage for further efforts to get a better sense for what are the things that are kind of holding us back from enhanced groundwater protection, what are the strategies that would be most effective for moving us forward, so using that one-time funding to really provide that information to shape those future activities. And then to develop an approach to incorporate groundwater protection into those local water plans to get a better sense of what it would take and what are effective strategies, so we can then use that information to determine what it would take to scale that up to address all of the vulnerable aquifers in Minnesota and all of those county and other local water plans. And then third, to fund activities to support those informed management decisions, to make sure that the information is accessible so that it can be used in those decision-making processes. So the report, again, was submitted to the legislature on January 7th, and there's a link there as to where to find the report on the PCA's website. And with that, I want to thank you again for the opportunity just to provide the brief overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was rather taken aback when I read your report and said that this was one-time only money, because I never heard that mentioned in any of our discussions. The intention was that we know that groundwater is something that the agencies have not concentrated on, and that this was the beginning of a long-term stream of funding so Minnesota actually has a groundwater plan. So I don't view that as one-time money. But my biggest problem with reading your report is that while you cited one of our statutes, the other statute said that for every project we have to have measurable outcomes, and then you have to be able to evaluate, did you meet that measurable outcome? And we don't have that in your groundwater plan. It's more, let's just send out some money and see what happens, which is what we've been doing for years, and that's why we have our problems. So I think we're going to have to be a little more precise in what we do to protect groundwater. I don't think we're quite there yet. But I will tell you, Madam Chair, that there was a DNR has come before our committee in an opportunity that we haven't had in this committee about some well monitoring, so we can actually measure what we're doing. And they have a fairly large proposal, and I think it might be a good idea for this committee to hear that proposal. Because you did talk about measuring, you know, monitoring, more monitoring that's needed, and data integration. The DNR has a very specific report on that, not a general report, and I think it would be good for this committee to hear that very specific report.
Ms. Lotthammer.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, yes. I am aware of the DNR's report, and in fact, the staff that worked on that report also participated in developing this proposal. And really, kind of the way that we were thinking about this was that we recognized that there were long-term needs and long-term opportunities, and at the same time, we had this appropriation that was available for this one year, and we didn't want to presume how the legislature would be interested in funding things into the future. So we really focused on what are some things that we could do immediately that could help kind of inform that discussion. And we talked a lot about, you know, recognizing the need for more support for local government decisions and local planning efforts and also state agency planning efforts. But we really had a challenge with what's the best way to do that? You know, what's the best delivery mechanism and what are the best strategies to use? So the idea here was to really just spend a little bit of time exploring what some of the best opportunities might be so that we have that information then to shape those future discussions and the future efforts going forward. And we would definitely work very hard to put measurable outcomes and evaluation aspects into the pass-through funding that would go for those projects so that it would be very clear what the outcomes would be from those efforts, because we definitely recognize the importance of that.
Thank you, Ms. Lotthammer. Mr. Skuta, I think this committee has demonstrated their interest in water, clean water, and groundwater, and the civic engagement, and I think we will probably be inviting you back for a more intensive discussion at a later time, but we'll receive these and review them and come back with thoughtful questions in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the people here today and yesterday. I know we gave you a lot to do over a pretty short amount of time as we sort of lay the groundwork for accomplishments here. And as you're going through, I was kind of comparing our first agenda item yesterday with our legislative guidelines with sort of the reports on the first year activities, and some really paralleled and some didn't. And I just encourage us all to keep the dialogue going about how to keep our visions merging together as we move forward.
A good reminder. The next item on our agenda is the Representative Kahn's initiative to talk about co-location of the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Council on Affairs of Chicano Latino People, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Metropolitan Area Office of the Indian Affairs Council. And we have received a report, and we want to cover it briefly because the next item on the agenda could be affected by it. Ms. Redens.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Renee Redens, and I'm a management consultant at Management Analysis and Development, which is a division in Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm going to present briefly the key findings and conclusions from the study on the potential co-location of the offices of the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Metropolitan Office of the Indian Affairs Council. The statutory directive and the purpose of the study was to examine and report on the potential for cost savings, the timing of those savings, and the effect on the Council's operations of potential co-location. I just wanted to briefly touch on the study's methods before I go into the findings. We conducted several, probably over 40 stakeholder interviews to collect both qualitative and quantitative data to get into the cost and then also the operational needs of the councils. We met with all of the council's executive directors and staff. We attended a couple board meetings and an executive committee meeting, and we contacted all of the council's legislative appointees and interviewed several of them. We also depended on the cooperation and assistance from the Department of Administration's Real Estate and Construction Services, SMART, which is a small agency resource team, and OET. We met with the council's directors and talked to them several times throughout the study to share information as it was available, and they were very cooperative. And just a couple key assumptions before going into the findings as well that kind of provide some context and background to the findings. The report that we outlined offers five different space options, and they're in the executive summary on pages 4 and 5. Three of them are state-owned options, and the other are privately owned options. For the state-owned options, the analysis was based on costs associated with specific office spaces that were currently available in state-owned buildings. So Real Estate and Construction Services identified two office spaces that are currently available in state-owned buildings, and those are in the Centennial Tunnel level and the Administration Building, the second floor, and then the private-owned options. However, we were advised by the Real Estate and Construction Services that listing or even inquiring about them at this time would be premature, and it would negatively impact the state's ability to negotiate a favorable lease term. So what we did for the private options was basically presented conceptual designs for them, and the costs were theoretical based on square footages that were from other models but not necessarily on specific spaces. We took into consideration the specific operational needs of the councils by interviewing them. Some of the ones that emerged to the top were having a location that was near the Capitol, easily accessible buildings and office space, and adequate space for conference rooms and functionality in meeting with clientele, low-cost parking availability for clientele. Identity, privacy, and autonomy also was very important, security, safety, and having administrative support. Their current square footage, if you took all of the four councils together right now, is slightly over 4,200 square feet. They also met with the Real Estate and Construction Services in the middle of our study to do a space needs analysis. It was kind of the first step in terms of if they were to move, identifying the space that's what they would need. And they identified that they could, you know, cut some of that off, about 16% to 3,500 square feet. So that's what we tried to kind of match our options with in the event that they were to co-locate. As the study directed us to look at cost savings and timing and effect, we didn't do an organizational analysis. So basically, we didn't, you know, identify or look for efficiencies or inefficiencies or identify opportunities for streamlining or reorganization. So we didn't make any recommendations on reduced staffing or functions or positions. And additionally, the information that we collected throughout the interviews through all of, for several of the stakeholders didn't really point to any obvious opportunities for staff reductions. So just briefly on the findings, we found that co-location overall with the options that we analyzed does not provide significant cost savings. However, with the limitations in only looking at two state-owned spaces that were available to analyze during the time frame and the inability to really look specifically at private-owned spaces, that's what we had concluded with that. There are a couple of the options that do present reoccurring net cost savings, but they're fairly minimal. And if you wanted to look further into that, they're on page 5 of the executive summary, and they're options 1 and 4. Option 1 is a shared suite in the Centennial Tunnel. Savings would be minimal, and they wouldn't be realized by all of the councils. In fact, for most of the options, three of the councils would have an increase in lease cost. The amount of the savings would be roughly, you know, slightly $900. That would be collectively for all four councils. And that wouldn't be in taking in consideration high renovation costs that would be required to get the space to what they would need. So if you did take into consideration the renovation costs and amortize that over 4 years with 0% interest, which is a discretionary decision of the Plant Management Division in Department of Admin, that would be an increase of actually $800 a month over that four-year time period. So after the 4 years, they could actually have savings of around $900. But again, that's collectively, and that's not spread across the councils evenly. And option 4, again, was the private location, and it's also a shared suite option. And that, again, was based on theoretical costs. So there could be reoccurring monthly savings of even less, maybe $400, but that's based on the assumption that the lease rate is the lowest amount possible. And we were given lease rates by the Real Estate and Construction Services of about $18 per square foot. So if the space, however, were larger or didn't, you know, wasn't the 3,500 square feet that they needed, or if the lease rates were higher, then there wouldn't be savings. Most of the options, you know, do meet the basic operational needs of the councils, but again, there are several trade-offs to consider. The shared space configuration, which are the only two options that really present any opportunities for savings, are not what the councils are necessarily looking for in terms of maintaining that kind of identity and privacy with serving their clientele. They would prefer separate suites. So we did have an option in there with the separate but adjacent suites, but they didn't provide any opportunities that we saw for cost savings. And again, through sharing equipment and resources like phones and other equipment, we received some information and cost estimates from OAT, and they gave us estimates based on basically if they were to move, they would be upgrading their services from what they were at now. They're currently really not spending too much on technology, so those costs would also increase significantly, or could increase. So I guess a couple final points would be that, you know, future state or privately owned options may present a better, you know, set of opportunities for the for co-location or cost savings. Real Estate and Construction Services also noted that additional state space could open at any time or when the leases are up, which is in June 30th of 2011. And, you know, they've already met with the councils to conduct the space needs analysis, so if they were interested in, you know, diving into the private market, they could do so. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Those are the findings. Thank you.
I think you did. Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman and members, one of the options, and I gather it's Thanks very much. This is really, you know, we've had a conversation about it earlier. This is really a very well-done report, and it really, I think, cleared up a lot of myths that's been presented at all times, that there were enormous savings available and that all kind of thing. And that, you know, and I think that this was, putting this study in place is much better than some unilateral actions that had started to occur during the last year. But one of the things that came up, and I guess it came up informally and it never got into the report, and I think it was suggested by the chairs of one of the council, which looks very interesting and very exciting, is the idea of co-locating and moving them all into the old Gillette Hospital that the Humanities Council now is. That's the old Humanities Council already has a lot of work with several of the councils on you know, actions that they're doing jointly together. And I think it's an incredibly attractive space. The space is available. There's extra space there that's actually used as residential facilities at times when they're doing conferences. And this would be, you know, I think, I don't want to say that the councils are all in agreement, but there is certainly interest expressed from at least some of the councils. I think the Humanities Executive Director is very interested in it, and it's something maybe to look at, I think, at the time when the leases are up. You know, so I'm not, I don't know that we need any legislation to advance it, but, you know, I could imagine that all the interested people are here in this room at this time, and so just putting out in public this as a possibility to be looked at would be a good idea.
I think that's a very good suggestion, Representative Kahn, but I think maybe the four councils are going to be wondering if they can stay where they're at when we get the next item on the agenda. Because the knife was not kind. Thank you so much, Ms. Rubens, and we will receive and meditate on your recommendations. It really doesn't help us a whole lot. But it was very well done.
Nicely done. I wonder if that makes you feel good.
Representative Kahn.
That's why we have people who know how to count and deal with numbers and analysis rather than politicians.
That's right. And I like the word that you used before, too. It clarified some myths that are out there. And the next item on the agenda, Ms. Mack. The minutes from the 37th and 38th meeting are in our packets. Ms. Mack.
I'd like to move the minutes.
Ms. Mack, Representative Mack moves adoption of the minutes as printed for the 37th and 38th meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The next item on the agenda is the presentation of the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. And obviously we're going to have to continue after, but thank you for coming, Mr. Boomtruck.
Bomb truck.
And Ms. Barondo.
Barondo, Madam
Chair. Barondo.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Madam Chair and
will
members.
Will you come back?
We will definitely come back.
All right, but let's get a little start.
So thanks for the opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget. My name is Ryan Bomtrog. I am an executive budget officer for Minnesota Management and Budget. And we're here today to go through the governor's supplemental budget recommendations for those agencies that have their budgets underneath this committee's jurisdiction. Generally speaking, the governor's supplemental budget proposes operating cuts equal to 6% in fiscal year 10 and 11,
Part of those cuts, as we'll see, are line items in each of the agencies' budgets, and the remainder is shown under a single line item in Minnesota Management and Budgets line items. So we'll start working off the document that is titled Governor's 2010 Supplemental Budget Recommendations, and we'll start with the Zoological Board. And I understand we don't have much time, so we'll go quickly, but we'll be back again to answer any further questions. The operating budget reduction for the Zoo Board is a 3% reduction, which amounts to $24,000 in fiscal year 10 and $197,000 in fiscal year 11. And that's also carried is in their base for a reduction into 12 and 13. Next, we'll go on to the Arts Board. The Arts Board's proposal is similar to the Governor's 2010-11 recommendation for the Arts Board, and it reduces the Arts Board's general fund appropriation by $2,875,000 in fiscal year 11 and reduces it further by $5,749,000 in fiscal year 12 as they transition to a private nonprofit. In fiscal year 13, the Governor doesn't recommend funding for the Arts Board. The next agency is Explore Minnesota Tourism. They receive approximately $10.7 million. Of that $10.7 million, $9.2 is for tourism operating and programs, and $1.5 million is for the Film Board Operating and Grants Program. The Governor's rec for tourism is a 3% operating reduction in fiscal year 10 and 11, as well as in 10, elimination of the Innovative Grants Program of $47,000 in fiscal year 11. For the Film Board, the Governor's recommendation is to reduce the Film Jobs Production Program by $700,000 in fiscal year 11, or in fiscal year 10 rather, and then eliminate the general fund appropriation to the Film Board for operations in fiscal year 11. In fiscal year 12, the operating reduction is continued out, and the $1.2 million that was provided to the Film Board for the Film Jobs Production Program was line item vetoed in fiscal year 11, so it does not have a base moving forward. Moving on to the Historical Society, in fiscal year 10 and 11, the Governor's supplemental rec is to reduce their operating budget by 3% in fiscal year 10 and 11. In fiscal year 10, that's $217,000, and in fiscal year 11, that's $501,000. The extension of the Governor's executive actions in 10 and 11 into 12 and 13 further increased that reduction by $168,000 in fiscal year 12 and 13. The Minnesota Humanities Center receives $250,000 in general fund money each year. The Governor's supplemental budget recommendation is to eliminate that general fund appropriation of $250,000. And then the Public Facilities Authority receives general fund money for the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Grant Program, and the Governor's supplemental budget is to reduce that grant program by $11,000 in fiscal year 10 and $7,000 in fiscal year 11.
The Amateur Sports Commission has a recommendation of a 3% general fund reduction of unspent funds in fiscal year 10 and 3% in fiscal year 11. The commission plans to implement that reduction by transferring some of the salary costs to a contract they have with Hennepin County to help administer the county's amateur sports grant program. Then the next is the Asian Pacific Council. This is the first of four councils with very similar reductions. The governor has recommended a 3% reduction of the unspent general fund dollars in fiscal year 10 and 3% going forward each year. The next council is the Black Minnesotans Council, and it is a similar 3% reduction in of the unspent funds in 10 and going forward in 11, 12, and 13. Chicano Latino Affairs Council also has the similar 3% reduction. The Indian Affairs Council similarly has the 3% reduction of the unspent funds in fiscal year 10 and 3% going forward in 11, 12, and 13. The Admin Department has a recommendation relating to its public broadcasting grants, and this results in the elimination of several public broadcasting grants that are listed there on your sheet, and it is a total of $2,015,000 in each of 11, 12, and 13. Then the last page is a summary from the website on the overall governor's supplemental recommendations, looking at the various categories of reductions overall to the state budget.
Well, this is a little grim.
Yes, but, Madam Chair.
We do have questions, and talking about what we would like to know, some of the discussions, especially on the where the money was eliminated totally and where they are supposed to be self-sustaining and go off on their own. We would like some information about the direction, what your office thought was going to happen to them then and going forward. And we also will have some particular discussions about the impact of the numbers. And then we're going to give the agencies affected the possibility to react and tell us what their problems will be. And so I'm sure we have at least, I would think, at least 30 to 60 minutes of greater conversations about the initial proposal. And so we do invite you back. Thank you so much.
Good night, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This meeting is adjourned.